May I please the court?
Yes, may proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to address briefly two issues here at the outset. First, I hope that the court, I expect the court to, and I hope the court will consider my arguments in both this case involving Mr. Rean and the next case involving Mr. Trotter to be applicable to both cases, except, of course, as to the differences in their disciplinary histories and how those things should affect the ultimate sanction imposed in respective cases. The cases come out of the same representation. They were co-counsel. The allegations are the same. We think they're equally responsible, culpable, and they've never raised anything so far anyway that would give any indication that they see differences in their respective culpability. Second, I should clarify.
So why did you give them separate discipline? Why did you give them different discipline?
Why are we asking for different discipline
yes.
in the case? Yes, the disciplinary history of the two lawyers is significant. The history of Mr. Trotter is significantly different than that of Mr. Rean. And we'll talk.
And Mr. Rean had just one small prior admonition, and
that's
Mr.
Right.
Trotter had a several prior.
Yes. Okay. Yes. The second thing, and then we'll probably get straight into the sanction analysis, is that I think I should clarify how I think the court should look at the remaining counts and the information that were not part of the stipulation. Mr. Trotter's brief accurately characterizes the issue when it indicates that the court, we think the court should consider those counts withdrawn. We stipulated to four of the counts. There are three counts remaining, and so it would not be fair, in my analysis, for these lawyers to sanction them for those violations when they're neither admitted, nor stipulated, nor tried.
So because you reached a stipulation, you did not, they would be entitled, in your view, should the court, are those dropped and they're gone, or should the court think we should proceed on them, would they need to go back down for a DHP hearing? Because there has not been stipulation.
I'll try two answers. I'll say they're withdrawn.
Okay.
For that record.
The stipulation did not say they were withdrawn.
The stipulation did not say that. That's right. And so if the court decided that they wanted to be, that they should consider discipline for them, then I think that there should be a remand. Because this, we're not.
They were not rejected, but they're not part of this case.
Right. But we don't think a remand is necessary or appropriate. I mean, the key charges are addressed in the information. The remaining charges, even if established by preponderance, would not, in our view, change the sanction analysis. I mean, it would be cumulative, and maybe cumulative always adds a little bit, but it's not, there's nothing in them that we think that would change what sanctions are appropriate for either of the attorneys. So that's why we are agreeing to withdraw them and take that issue off the table. The background of these attorney discipline charges is a tragic crash involving a car and a large truck in 2008. Christina Meese was in the car. Her boyfriend, Mark Barton, was driving the car. Miss Meese's three young daughters, were in the back seat. The youngest daughter was also Mr. Barton's daughter. And pursuant to construction zone flagman's instructions, they were stopped when the truck crashed into the rear of their car. Miss Meese suffered a broken neck. Mr. Barton had serious head injuries, and the three girls in the back seat all died.
Now, I remember there was an Iowa airplane crash. And now, in this case, a family member approached the lawyer, and the family member got together, and they came and visited the mother in the hospital to sign her up. There was an Iowa airplane crash where I think they really, in Iowa at least, they said this was inappropriate when someone's in the hospital to approach them for a contract for a legal representation.
Right.
I mean, what happened is the good lawyers, whoever they were, decided to send on the victims' families and sign them up immediately after all these people had died in this airplane crash, and it was seen some reason they still thought it was an inappropriate solicitation of clients. But this was this. How did the Office of Chief District Counsel feel about this kind of approach? My family's still in the hospital, three children dead, as you just indicated, the injuries.
Right. The trauma was undoubtedly more than any of us can imagine. If that were the case here, then we would be arguing for discipline for that misconduct. I mean, it would be misconduct. The Judge Perry, who had the case and did review that issue, because there were...
Here, counsel was called and asked to come to the hospital, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes.
So it's very
right.
different.
But even then, I mean, because there were concerns of that, and because they did come that, you know, within a day. So, but the court, Judge Perry did review that issue and determined that Mr. Trotter was called by family of Ms. Meese, the mother of the girls.
Now, Judge Perry also reviewed the issue, I assume, that the not delivering the file over. I mean, part of what we try to do is protect the public, but it's also to protect the integrity of the profession. That it takes a federal judge to order the file to be turned over to the client. What did you folks think of that?
Well, I mean, that is not one of the charges that we ended up with.
And so that's the question. You said we can't, because those charges are withdrawn. Are those facts withdrawn? I mean, that can't be the basis for this court's decision of what's appropriate or inappropriate behavior, or?
Yes, that's right. I mean, that would be our position.
Because they haven't been proven?
They're not been proven, and now they're withdrawn.
And there's been no hearing on them.
And there's been no hearing on them.
But you said
I mean, the respondents' counsel may be able, would probably like the opportunity to explain that there were timing issues and that there were issues. In fact, when they were asked to withdraw, the first thing they did was to contact legal ethics counsel, get an opinion about whether they could continue to try to communicate with the clients, and they found that out, and then they.
But all that's not before us, you're saying, and there's been no hearing before.
Some of it is in the record. I mean, it is in the record of the case.
What are the four charges that are before us? So that can help focus our question.
All right, thank you. They stipulated to four things. The first one is the fee agreement did not disclose how expenses were to be handled, though there was a discussion, an oral discussion, indicating expenses were to be subtracted before calculating the 33 1/3% fee. That's a violation of Rule 4-1.5.
But if I understand correctly, so I'll stop to clarify. Okay. There's no claim they were going to deduct the expenses just from her share. They were going to do it off the top before they figured their...
Yes, that's my understanding.
But it's the failure to reveal how they were going
to
do it.
It's a failure to put it in writing is the violation. And the second one in the stipulation anyway, is that neither the fee agreement nor any other writing established Mr. Reen's participation in the case, though factually Ms. Meese, the client, and Mr. Barton clearly understood that Mr. Reen was involved. They communicated with him throughout the case. Their letter to ask him to withdraw was to Mr. Reen. I mean, he was involved. They knew it. There was really no question. Again, that's a violation because that was the kind of thing that should be in writing and is required to be in writing.
So again, in both these, there's no misleading, but there is a violation of the rules, which are intended to make sure there's no misleading.
Yes.
But in fact, in this case, there was not.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And the third violation is a conflict violation, in that the respondents failed to obtain written informed consent to represent both Barton and Meese, the driver and the mother in the case, in that at least after they separated, and they separated within a few months after this accident, that they had an inherent future conflict in trying to apportion whatever proceeds of any wrongful death recovery as to their mutual daughter. Somebody, you know, that pie was going to be a limited pie at some point, and the same lawyers would be in the middle of deciding who gets what piece of the pie if they don't work it out.
But it's one pie, and so there's, so you're saying that was a violation?
Yes, and they agree. They agree that it should have, that they, at least at the point of the breakup, that it would have been a good idea and more compliant with the rule.
As a result of these complaints, have you reviewed their files to see if there are any other agreements such as this or any other arrangements such as this?
Not at this point. And under the, I hate to get it too far ahead, but under the terms of the sanction that we're requesting with Mr. Trotter's case, the next case, then there are several conditions of probation. But no, we haven't restarted reviewing the files in advance of the sanction. And the fourth violation is also a conflict violation. It's the former client violation, Rule 4-1.9, and it involves the same issues. It's for continuing to represent Mr. Barton while without obtaining written informed consent from Ms. Meese after she discharged them, in that the future conflict over apportionment persisted after they withdrew from representing her.
But then again, when you're dealing with contracts, you would assume the same contract, the same arrangement, would have been prevailing in other arrangements with other clients. It's not something as a sort of a sui generis kind of a violation. It's something that would be consistent with the way they did arrangements on other cases. So,
well, we don't have evidence of that.
Well, wasn't there evidence they used this contract because they usually did criminal cases and they didn't have a standard civil contract, and so they borrowed one from that had been used by their predecessor?
That's close.
Okay.
Yes, that was Mr. Trotter's explanation. He initially was initial contact with the clients, and he used the a form that had been used by an attorney, a longtime Southwest Missouri attorney whose practice I think he took over. And so that's where it came from. We don't have evidence of what Mr. Reen's contracts would have looked like if he would have
we don't know where, because he didn't sign the contract. The contract
that's
was
right.
Not his contract. It
that's
was
right.
With Mr. Trotter.
In
so
your duty to protect the public, do you not have an investigatory responsibility?
Us?
Yes.
Yes. I'm sorry. For what, Your Honor? We do.
To make sure that the public's protected from other kinds of situations like this.
Well, right. And we think that's what we've done. That's what we've tried to do in this case, is to look into the things that, I mean, Judge Perry made, an extensive analysis, and we started with what she wrote as what we thought we should look at first. And that was, and then the rest, you know, comes out of the record that the attorneys have in the past as well. And
did Judge, what did Judge Perry find about the cause of the failure to recognize the conflict? Did she find it was negligent or what state of mind? Was it simply not understanding the rules, or was there something more serious in terms of?
Boy, it's in the record, and I don't remember her specifically analyzing or finding, making a finding as to whether it was intentional or not. I think the one part.
Did she refer them to you for discipline?
You know, sometimes we get cases from multiple sources.
I believe she did not make findings about violations of the rules of professional conduct. She was looking at whether they're entitled to a fee. Is that correct?
That was the reason for her looking at it at all.
Yeah.
Right. She was not doing a discipline investigation. She wasn't thinking about Rule 11 sanctions even. She was really looking at the question was the successor counsel said these lawyers should not be entitled to any fee because they violated the rules. And they had some law on that.
She found they provided some benefit and gave them 8%.
Exactly, 8%. And not expenses because their contract didn't spell it more clearly.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 3 minutes on rebuttal.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
I believe the disciplinary counsel's brief and statement of facts accurately described the events of this case, and I believe that Mr. Phillips' description of the failures of the fee agreement are accurate also. The one point that I would like to point out to the court is that it is not the requirement of the rule that the fee agreement include the fact that Mr. Reen is working on the case. It just has to be the knowledge that Ms. Meese and Mr. Barton had that Mr. Reen was participating in the case and they would be splitting a fee was to be confirmed in writing to them. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it had to be part of the fee agreement. It could have been a letter, could have been something else. This rule came into effect approximately 3 months before the representation was undertaken. Mr. Reen freely acknowledges and admits that this was a violation of the rule. And the fee agreement that he was operating under was also did not comply with the rule.
Is there any evidence as to what type of fee agreement he normally uses and whether it's more detailed than this?
There's no evidence in the record, Your Honor. I can state from personal experience in dealing with Mr. Reen that it is significantly better drafted. So,
He's not the one who presented or signed this agreement, but he did then agree to additionally represent the clients.
That's correct.
What's the nature of Mr. Reen's practice?
Mr. Reen's practice is primarily civil litigation. He does a fair amount of personal injury work in other commercial cases. Mr. Reen and I probably litigate against each other about three times a month, and primarily civil cases. He also does some criminal work.
The brief didn't indicate this, but I assume Mr. Reen expressed remorse since he's admitted to all these violations.
Yes, ma'am, and I think the last paragraph of the brief does that. I think he's very remorseful, and really he accepted the reprimand freely, and wants to move forward and make any corrections that he needs to make and continue to practice law.
So he will make sure he looks at the agreements in the future and that they contain all the requirements of the rule?
I think that's a very good assumption, Your Honor.
A significant violation, though, is the conflict. The question under the ABA standards is whether it was a knowing violation or a negligent violation. And once they broke up and there was the interest of Ms. Meese to have a division different than what they had stipulated or agreed to, how is that not knowing?
I think that you take the time frame into consideration. I think with wrongful death or any car accident case where the driver and the passenger, you've always got that issue. In this case, I mean, this is a very unique case in that the driver was stopped for a flagman and was rear-ended. No one in this case has ever alleged that Mr. Barton was in any way negligent. The wrongful death case that, you know, until the Judge Perry found that there was a potential conflict at the apportionment stage. There's no question that in the wrongful death, there's one wrongful death case. And everyone is entitled to an indivisible part of the wrongful death. So until the apportionment stage, there really wasn't a conflict.
Well,
now,
so they were going to, who was, they thought they'd have to bring in new counsel then? I mean, why not get a written waiver of any conflict early on and avoid all these issues?
That, in hindsight's 20/20, and it should have been done. Originally, the agreement, and it was presented to Mr. Reen originally, the agreement between Ms. Meese and Mr. Barton was that they were going to do a 50-50 split. After the litigation started or the case proceeded, their relationship dissolved. Well, then almost a year later is when Ms. Barton or Ms. Meese, and this goes to Judge Breckenridge's question, that Ms. Meese asked Mr. Ream to ask Mr. Barton if he would agree to a 60-40 split because Mr. Barton wasn't paying his administratively ordered child support on another child. Now, then Mr. Ream asked Mr. Barton. Mr. Barton said no, he would not agree to that. Judge Perry found that Mr. Ream did not communicate that back to Ms. Meese. However, the issue was not raised again until August when he was terminated. So we have from March of 2009 until August of 2009 that Ms. Meese apparently was satisfied that the agreement had not been changed. But going to the question, at that point, we acknowledge that Mr. Ream should have recognized the potential conflict or the conflict, and he was negligent in not doing so.
How do we have any assurance that this won't occur in the future?
I think that in the future, I think this case has been a very trying case, both personally for Mr. Ream and professionally for Mr. Ream, and that I think that when you live through one of these circumstances and you didn't recognize it, the next time through, I'm certain that he will recognize that conflict and get the waiver that he should have gotten at that time. You know, at some point in time, after March of 2009.
Now, the waiver is to protect the lawyer. It's not necessarily to deal with the conflict. I mean, you might be asking for a waiver, but that's because you want to protect yourself from any lawsuits because of a conflict. But yet, you know, in his wrongful death cases, and when there's a, whenever I had a case where the family was splitting up, there was always a potential conflict of how they wanted to deal with the money. That it's not hindsight, it's foresight that we're looking at in a lawyer who's supposed to exercise good judgment with respect to their clients and themselves.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with that, and I've learned the lesson that in wrongful death cases, I took one sometime after that, and I got the waiver up front of the potential conflicts between the family members.
Where there's an actual conflict, you can't waive it so easily. So wasn't this an actual conflict once they disagreed on the split?
I don't believe it was, because I don't think it ever got to that stage, even though Judge Perry's findings said that he did not get back to her, because I think the request was made. Mr. Ream testified that that he had rejected it.
There's not been a request for collateral discipline, so we're not bound by the collateral discipline rules. Normally you're bound. If there had been a disciplinary hearing in another forum, the OCDC might ask us to take those facts as determined. But there was no disciplinary proceeding. This was a court proceeding, and they've not requested us to do that.
Right. Is that correct? That case was all about fees.
That was all about fees.
And essentially, the other lawyers in the case were using the disciplinary rules as a club to in order to try to get Mr. Ream and Mr. Trotter deprived of any fee in this case.
And in fact, the other attorneys got 25% instead of 33%, and the 8% went to your clients.
It's my understanding that their fee was in excess of the 33%, but I don't believe there's anything in the record.
Were any disciplinary proceedings brought against them? Because I understand it would probably be a disciplinary problem to use that as a club, use a discipline as a club to get yourself more money on attorney's fees.
We have not raised that issue, and I doubt we probably will not intend to do so. We would like to end this matter as quickly as possible.
They did so openly in court, not by letter or threat.
That's correct.
Counsel, if we follow this recommendation, though, one serious violation that Judge Perry found
which had to do with failure to return the file and to actively oppose the discharge, goes untried and unpunished. Why is that in the best interest of the public or the profession?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that was all a matter of timing. We're looking at a period here. It started, and my dates are close, so approximately August 20th is when Mr. Reen received a fax from Mr. Sachs's office that purported to have a statement that said from Ms. Meese that you're discharged. That they attempted then to, they wrote back Mr. Sachs, said that they would not take any further action in the case. They then asked the disciplinary counsel as far as could they still contact the client. They attempted to contact the client through this period, and the client would not talk to them or would not return their phone call. And then the client filed a, quote, pro se motion to have them withdrawn from the case. And so, you know, we're talking a period of approximately 2 weeks.
And I understood at the beginning they weren't sure, was this really the client? Was this other counsel who had sent the letter, and did the client want that? When the client filed something and they opposed it, that seems to be going far beyond.
That was a mistake when they did that.
If that's not before us now, is there anything barring that from being looked at and an appropriate hearing, if that's appropriate or not? Or is it your position that it's sort of dismissed with prejudice?
Well, it's my position, Your Honor, it's dismissed with prejudice. I believe where the disciplinary counsel withdrew it, and this matter has come to the court, then I think that it's essentially raised.
Do we give any weight at all to the federal judge's findings in her decision, even though she didn't file a complaint? They didn't take discipline against her in the federal court, but should we not give any weight to the federal judge's opinion?
It's my belief that the findings of the federal judge are not entitled to collateral estoppel in this case, even though I believe it's the position of the disciplinary counsel that they are, because it's a different issue. They were litigating over fees. And essentially, the issues in that case were whether Mr. Reen and Mr. Trotter were entitled to any portion of this wrongful death fee.
Well, they haven't introduced those facts as ones that we should give collateral effect to. All are relying on stipulation only, so that would be a change from the submission.
That's correct. Back to the question that Judge Wilson asked concerning the timing, and I want to go back to the timing. I mean, this was spinning, and a week before, Mr. Reen had received a request from the client wanting money from him, which he properly declined. Well, then a week later, the client notifies him, or he doesn't know if it's the client, but he gets notified that he's being discharged. Well, immediately, you want to find out what's going on. Now, should the file have been provided more promptly? Probably. Should they have opposed their motion or the motion to for them to be put off the case? No, they shouldn't. They shouldn't have done it. But those aren't the issues before the case. Mr. Reen very much would like to resolve this matter. We believe that an admonition on the first on the fee agreements is more appropriate, but we agreed to a reprimand on both of the counts just to resolve this issue.
Did your client seek, besides seeking counsel from the bar, counsel. Did they seek counsel themselves as far as what they should be doing from people experienced in this field?
I don't know that, Your Honor, one way or the other. It would just be speculation on my part.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Phillips, is there any limitation on OCDC's ability to withdraw complaints if it hasn't been formally done before today and we're hearing a proceeding on it? Does the Chief Disciplinary Counsel have the authority to remove from consideration certain charges in the information? I have no idea.
Right. I know the history. I don't know that it's ever been analyzed as to whether there are particular limitations. I know that I've done it in the past. I don't know that I've ever done it in oral argument, but I know I've done it in briefs before. If we get to the point of a brief where for instance, putting together the record and seeing the allegations that were found, if I see that the panel, for instance, or just made some finding and there's no evidence of it at all to support it, then I've declared them dismissed in the brief. It seems to be a practical way to approach something if we just don't think we should be moving forward on it. I'm not saying that's this case, but it certainly that has happened in the past. I think there's some old law that the court can do whatever it wants to protect the public. You know, the court doesn't need us when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, but there's been no hearing here.
But right, and, I mean, but proceed in the sense that, that's an old-fashioned way of saying it, but where's the process? I mean, without some...
There's a whole different issue of process versus
exactly.
Can the court proceed on a charge that OCDC chooses not to proceed on?
Yes.
As a prosecutor, do you have prosecutorial discretion, or is that apply, or is it different because of the different nature of sanctions analysis?
We've always assumed we do. I mean, I don't think the system would work if we didn't. I mean, if we see a violation, then we should be bringing it. I mean, I think that part is in the rule. If we see a violation that we can, I should back up on that. If we see a violation that we think is provable to a preponderance of the evidence, then we should be bringing it.
And this is the side issue, but of course if there are violations you didn't know about or you decided not to bring it one time and they weren't part of this and then later on you investigated and decided to bring them, you could do so. But is this something where originally you brought them and then you dropped them? Does that have any kind of effect of that you can't later pursue?
I don't really see how it'd be any different. I mean, here's another example of how it happened. If a lawyer is suspended, for instance, for some serious violations, and we have pending a bunch of other maybe serious or at least middle of the road type of violations, then we typically do not proceed on those. I mean, because it could be that it's not completely moot, because theoretically they could be disbarred from this.
Are you barred from doing so? Or are there cases addressing that?
I don't think we are barred from it. When we have done that in the past, the court sometimes is trying to remember how it worked. Considered our actions moot. If we weren't asking for additional sanction than what's already in place, in other words, if there's a suspension in place and we seek disbarment, then the court's willing to hear that. If they're suspended and we want to extend the suspension, then that's another thing.
Here, all these things, there were seven counts to the information, but you filed the stipulation here just as to four.
Yes.
Those are the only ones you're asking us to proceed on, and you're here withdrawing the other three.
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you, on the three you said that are withdrawn, maybe with prejudice, who knows, you made a statement, I believe I heard early on, that even if those had proceeded, it wouldn't change your recommendation.
That's right.
That's right. We're entitled to take judicial notice of, even though we may not have a hearing, we were able to take judicial notice of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Missouri's decision, can we not?
Yes. I don't think that goes as that, even under collateral, even if we ask the court to collaterally stop the respondents from relitigating the facts, that's all we would be asking the court to do. We would not be asking the court to find, we would then acknowledge that we would still have to establish that her findings of fact would establish violations. We wouldn't say, just because Judge Perry said they violated the rules, we wouldn't say this court must also make those findings.
Particularly if the issue before her wasn't whether or not
right.
rules were violated.
Well, right. Counsel, the information charge violation of 1.16 for
yes.
failing to withdraw in a timely manner, for not producing the file when
right.
requested, and for opposing the motion. The pro se motion to withdraw, right?
Yes.
So that's in the information.
It is.
In the stipulated facts, they admit to all of those facts. They admit to what they admit, correct?
Right.
Okay, so those admissions are binding. And if it, the way I read Rule 5.19, if we reject the panel's decision, then we can either fine for the respondent, or if we court finds professional misconduct charged in the information, it shall impose appropriate discipline. So why couldn't we use the admission insofar as they're adequate to prove the other charges?
I think that the admissions were made at a time when they understood that we were not proceeding on those particular charge.
They've had no opportunity to defend why those admissions don't constitute a violation of those other rules, because it was only charged as a violation of these. You can't, like,
right.
you can't add new criminal statute violations.
And I don't know whether we're right or not, but frankly, we get lots of fail to return files promptly charges, and most of them don't end up here. And most of them are admonition cases. Or sometimes we call the lawyer and say, return the file now, and that'll take care of it. I mean, so we're not talking, it is offensive to us, but it is the kind of thing that too many lawyers do, and they don't often result in even reprimands, except after multiple times and such. Sorry.
Okay, any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.